Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. And we are thrilled to welcome our latest supporter on board, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder and Dr. Alana Conder at Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh. They specialize in assessing and treating brain disorders. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Everyone is well aware that the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries are major economic drivers here in the Triangle, but fewer people seem to be aware of the fact that we are also ground zero for another vital life sciences industry, companies called contract research organizations, or CROs. We have the biggest and the most CROs here in the Triangle, providing a wide range of important services to pharmaceutical companies. CROs began as small boutique firms offering narrowly targeted outsourcing services to pharmaceutical clients, but over the years they have expanded tremendously and now dominate drug development and clinical trial management. We are very fortunate to have with us on Radio In Vivo today an executive from the world's largest CRO, Quintiles. Dr. Raymond Hummel is going to share his knowledge with us about the industry, about his company, and about his fields of specialization, due diligence and regulatory affairs, and strategic drug development. Ray has been with Quintiles for more than 20 years now and has served in a variety of positions of increasing responsibility. Until recently, he was executive director and head of global due diligence, and now he is executive director of strategic drug development and head of global biosimilars strategic planning. Ray holds an MS in biology from East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania, and he earned his Doctor of Veterinary Medicine degree from the North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Along with his corporate responsibilities, he is still very much involved in the world of veterinary medicine as well. Ray, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why don't we begin our discussion today with a more detailed look at Quintiles itself. It is certainly one of the sterling success stories here in the Triangle. Would you kind of just give us a brief overview of the company as it exists today?
Sure, absolutely. We have a long legacy at Quintiles, having been started by the founder and original CEO of Quintiles, Dr. Dennis Gillings. He was a biostatistical professor at UNC Chapel Hill and served there for several years before starting Quintiles. Our foundation of Quintiles has always been based in biostatistics due to his scientific expertise, and we've grown over the last 30 years to be the largest contract research organization and service industry. We do things that are innovative than what we did, a while ago, and it's very exciting to be part of the growth. As you know, currently now we have close to 30,000 employees. We have worked on most of all of the drugs in some capacity. The most popular, I think it's the top 20 drugs that are currently on the market in some fashion. So we do have quite a insight and influence within the pharmaceutical market.
I can imagine so. What are the major business sectors that Quintiles is active in today?
Well, I think the core business that we've been known for and will continue to be known for is the running of clinical trials mm-hmm. and putting patients first and trying to get medicines to patients in the best manner possible. We work in a highly regulated environment, and so there are some constraints that we have to follow through within there. So that's one of our key business. There's kind of a research and development side to the business, which is, like I said, always the core. We also have a commercial side of the business where we've actually even had sales forces, the folks that actually are selling the products after they're approved. We've moved into other areas like payer and reimbursement areas where we have worked with large data or large databases of information, working to try to bring costs down and help with that as well. So we actually span the breadth of just about from the beginning to the end. At one point, Quintiles even did preclinical development, and we had some veterinarians, but that we don't have that portion of the business anymore. So I would say pretty much from early clinical development, which we call like phase one, where you mm-hmm. test things like in normal, healthy individuals in general.
Sure.
All the way through phase three and then registration, regulatory registration. And we're in over 60 countries in the world, so we don't just do this in the U.S. and Europe and Japan, which are considered kind of our key large markets, but we also do it in a lot of other countries as well.
I see. So it's really become a totally global approach.
Absolutely. The world today is so big that we truly are. I would say a lot of the teams that I've worked with, usually half of them are ex-U.S., every day for Quintiles, it's normal to be working across different spectrums. When we work for behalf of our sponsors, our partners, and our allies, we just pull the best and brightest, whether they're located in Scotland or whether they're located in North Carolina.
I see. Very good. Well, I do want to spend a minute or two talking about the real success of this company, which, as I say, I think for the Triangle and the people of this area, is a real source of pride. And it become a major employer, of course, also, as you alluded to. I read that over the past decade, Quintiles has conducted 4,700 trials in 2.7 million patients. Now, that number may be even a little bit outmoded at this point, based on the research. But I also read in the paper the other day that the Quintiles just had its first $1 billion revenue quarter and is projected for 2014 revenue of over $4 billion. That's absolutely remarkable because I remember back in the day, not that long ago, when it was a very small company and everybody said, CRO, what's that?
Right. It has been an exciting ride, and I've considered it a privilege and an honor to have been part of that over the years. Just to tell you a little bit about how I originally got into it was my wife actually worked for Quintiles before me. She was the 85th Quintiles employee.
Wow.
So that was in the late 80s. I started there while I was in veterinary school in 1993. So I do have a history of working with Quintiles over 20 years, but I just mm-hmm. celebrated my 15th year last week, full-time, continuous.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen a lot of changes. We have added on to the company through different means, through acquisitions and things that, as well as our own organic growth. There's been an awful lot of changes, as you know. We have had three different CEOs. Dennis Gillings is the founder and remains our chairman. Mm-hmm. Our current CEO is Tom Pike. And we had another CEO that took us from when we were public and took us to be private. And then Tom took us from private to be public. So we have gone through an awful lot of change. We've touched a lot of patients. And I think our pride remains in the fact that we do bring many needed drugs to patients that otherwise would not have them with the speed and the agility. I would also say, too, that Quintiles has played a large portion in influencing the industry because drugs are very expensive. And Quintiles has played a major role in trying to bring them to the market faster and more efficiently. And it's not been without struggles, but to be a leader. But they have played a large role in that. And I'm very proud of that because, you know, let me give you an example. In my own family, you know, I've experienced Alzheimer's disease. My grandmother had it, and my father also had it. Mm-hmm. And when I worked in the investment world, we worked with a large cap pharmaceutical company where we worked with an investment that allowed them to study a small molecule and a monoclonal antibody, two different targeted approaches to treat Alzheimer's disease. And while I'm a veterinarian by training, I believe that now in some ways it's almost like working in herd management because I work with lots of people and work with a lot of things. And that understood by doing those trials, they understand more about the disease process, what works, what doesn't work. And to know that, you know, I contributed in some way makes it easy to get up in the morning and go to work knowing that at the end of the day, no matter what you work in, whether you're investments or most recently I work in biosimilars, but it's all about, you know, the patient and increasing our partners, sponsors, and allies' probability of success.
Absolutely. Well, I want to take you back and spend a little more time on the history of the company before we move on to some of the bigger picture information. Dr. Gillings, as you described, a remarkable man, and I understand he founded the company in 1982, and as you mentioned, he was a professor of biostatistics at UNC Chapel Hill. Tell us a little bit more about that initial foundation of what has turned out to be such a powerful company.
Well, I've never forgotten the fact that biostatistics is the core of our company, and even when I worked on due diligence teams, I would have never done due diligence on any product or to understand a portfolio of products without a biostatistician, a trained biostatistician. Mm-hmm. And it's treated me very well to try to keep that. So we also, you know, the other cores on the team would be people like regulatory affairs experts, of course, physicians, sometimes board certified physicians in a very therapeutic or very specific area, clinical pharmacologists, and a lot of others. And I think part of what the biostatistics has done is it's added a scientific rigor on what was already a decent way to deal with randomized double-blind clinical trials in general. But I think as the years have gone by, we've shown that there's different ways and sometimes very sophisticated ways. One way is called an adaptive trial where you can do several phases at one time. You can minimize the number of patients you need. You can get information to know whether to go forward in an appropriate manner, in a quicker manner. And Quintiles has been a leader in that. And I think really it's because of our leaders, including Dr. Gillings, kind of moving it in that direction. And also, he's such a visionary. And I consider it a real privilege to know him personally, is that, you know, he's not only looking at 1 or 2 or 3 years ahead, but he's looking at 5 or 10 years. He has a remarkable prescience to understand how things will work in the future and how to move, even though we're a large company, to try to be flexible and nimble to meet our customers' needs, sometimes even before they know they need it. I mean, there's been times even recently where we've moved from the really, I know you used the term before, contract research organization, and that would be a correct term. Mm-hmm. On one hand. On the other hand, I think we're more than that because we've moved. I remember when I worked in due diligence exercises, for example, and we were looked at sometimes as the hands and the feet of the industry because we ran a lot of clinical trials. But then when we showed them all of our experts and we kind of let them get to know us, our credibility shot up and they could understand that we actually could add things and show them things from all the things we've learned. Now that Quintiles has enjoyed a 30-year history, we've learned an awful lot and built up a lot of database from those numbers you mentioned as far as all those clinical trials.
Sure.
We had something that we used to term before, I don't know what the exact term is today, but we used to call it the boiler room. and it would have you could actually mine some of that data to determine not the exact patient data that would have, like, you know, identified things and stuff like that, because it's regulated, but just the general things of that. And there's a lot of learnings from that, and we apply that and share it with the new sponsors we have, so we can save them time, ultimately money, and ultimately get the patients faster. So I think that you know, the scientific rigor. Oh, and then the other thing I wanted to mention, mm-hmm. which I think is important, is that we can not only run the trials in a very efficient manner, but we also provide the group I worked in last year was the Center for Integrated Drug Development, and this is a bunch of folks that can also provide strategy for a company. So not only tell you how to get the drug approved, but how to get it approved with given the market dynamics and the perceived market dynamics in, say, the next 3 to 5 years. And that's a different paradigm, because now we're talking about the success of the molecule from kind of bedside all the way through, you know, I mean bench all the way through marketing. Mm-hmm. And that's a different paradigm now that we're being able to do the whole thing. Also, the fact that we have access to large databases, not just our own, but to look at that. We're used to dealing with big databases, and we discover things through looking at those databases. We have one tool called Infoserio I've worked with, and it's a holistic tool that by putting proprietary information and other information in, and then also using available sometimes of our own internal data and then putting it with public databases, it's a very powerful tool to show you in an objective manner different probabilities of success. And you can make decisions on that based on more objective rather than just a gut feel, mm-hmm. or your experience. You can look at subjective manners, and usually it comes down to, you know, things like market size or financial metrics or things like that. But you can give it an objective way in order to deal forward.
So, Ray, our contract research and also we should mention a big part of the business is contract sales forces, which was another innovation that that Quintiles really brought, pioneered. Are those still the core businesses today, or is the data mining and things of that nature that you described, are those types of services really expanding the business itself?
I think our core business is still that kind of clinical trial, like I said, or that side of that. Mm-hmm. And the commercial side of the business remains a core part of the business too. But I will say, as we've tried to not only keep up with the industry, but advance on the industry and also add dynamics to the industry, and it usually follows down to how can the drug best be safe for the patient, so while it's in clinical trials, and then once it gets out, to make sure that it gets there through compliance metrics or other things that are important for folks like payers and reimbursement, insurance companies and things like that, mm-hmm. to try to come to a more holistic view. There are things that we've gleaned where we sometimes not only help trials to get their drug approved with their own strategy, but now we're actually influencing the way companies are. We've actually signed a couple of very large deals with preferred providers, with Quintiles, where midsize and large pharma are coming to us now and doing preferred relationships, and we're actually taking their drug from all the way at the beginning, writing clinical drug development plans and taking it all the way through marketing. And that's a different paradigm. So now we're almost, we can add so much that we're actually becoming you know, an ally really to our folks, and we're not just the hands and feet anymore. We're actually adding information, and we're actually changing programs. We're telling folks, maybe this isn't the best way to go. This is a better way to go. This is this will take less patients to go this way. This mm-hmm. is a safer way, and things like that. And it's resonating with our partners, and we're seeing it more and more. I mean, one of the things today that is happening is that we have to move more efficiently and less expensively in order to go forward. Mm-hmm. We had something one time, it was called a 3-for-2 initiative, where to try to get 3 drugs to market for the price of 2. And, you know, we're calling it the new health landscape as part of that whole thing there. And so with the increased pricing pressure, there is greater outsourcing. So we're also seeing that folks are outsourcing services, parts of services, or even entire sections of services to Quintiles, whereas before, that was not the case.
I see. So, Ray, is the cost? What about the cost of bringing a new drug to market? Is it still? I think the rule of thumb over the last 5 or 10 years that start to finish, that was maybe about $1 billion, which makes these decisions, you know, so weighty. I'm sure you're right at the ground floor of a lot of that. Is that still the case, or has your industry been able to bring things to the table that are helping to kind of bring that down, or at least control growth?
Yeah, we have made a dent in it. I've heard figures thrown around too through like Tufts University sources or others that it's around $1 billion to $1.2 billion or whatever in about 10 years. So mm-hmm. those are figures that are thrown around quite a bit.
Sure.
So I think in general that's still probably generally true.
Okay.
I will say, though, that that's not acceptable anymore because it's too costly and it takes too long. And the other thing, too, is you're all doing it in the confines of a patent, right? So with an average patent, say, being 20 years, if it takes you 10 years to get there, you don't have much to get your return back through commercial sales or whatever.
Sure.
So you have to kind of think the whole thing on a on a return on investment, really. And I'll tell you a couple of things that I think how we've made a dent.
Okay.
Quintiles was working on a large phase 3 clinical trial for a CNS product, and this was for Alzheimer's disease as well. And if the product would go to market, of course, for a disease modification, it would be, you know, breathtaking because it would be groundbreaking. And I mean, there are no drugs for disease modification for Alzheimer's disease.
Sure.
And we actually worked on that phase 3 trial, and we recruited it and got the trial done 1 year ahead of schedule. Now, if you're talking on a 20-year time horizon for a patent, and you've just changed 1 year to get that potentially out to that, that's now you're talking huge financial ramifications. And also, though, more importantly, that it gets to the patient quicker.
Yeah.
That's 1 year that it could get to the patient quicker.
Sure.
And that's really what I think the game is all about, is that we want to get it quicker, but it's also under the paradigm that we have to remain and keep patient safety number one and foremost, because our reputation relies on it and the patient relies on it. And, you know, I was just talking to an executive board member this morning for coffee, and we both agreed that you know, you have to look at almost the construct as how would it affect your, you know, a loved one like your mom or your sister or one of your children or something like that. And if you keep it in that construct, I think it's easier to think about than if it's more abstract.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so much criticism from so many directions. People need to remember that the most important drugs that are out there, and virtually all of them, are products of this model.
Exactly.
Products of mainly from Big Pharma and those huge investments in research and development. So I wax poetic here, but so Ray, coming back to Quintiles itself, how can this remarkable company continue its really unprecedented track record of growth and expansion? Is there an upper limit given the state of the industry today, or does growth potentially come from increasing market share through aggressive competition and mergers and acquisitions and things like that? Or are new business areas presenting new opportunities for growth?
I think there's a little of the latter, and there's also some improvements on the former. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, as we try to improve probabilities of success by things like that example where I told you where we increased the recruitment rate by a year, even if you can reduce the recruitment rate by, you know, 3 months or 6 months, you know, and we're making strides towards increasing and getting drugs out there, shrinking that timeline down, mm-hmm. That's where we need to be. We also need to be thinking at the end of the day, a lot of times the old way kind of that I used to think about it too is to get the clinical trial work and then to get the patient through safely and then to move them on. But really, I think we need to look at it from a holistic standpoint that it really is all about the patient. So you have to take the patient at the beginning when you first study and then all the way through. And there are things out there like even social media and things that are influencing the way clinical trials and things may be done. I mean, social media has impacted our lives in ways that we never even imagined 20 years ago. And I think it's going to continue to impact our industry as well, too, the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is that as we move away from more of the clinical research organization construct to more of a partner and an ally and a pharmaceutical warehouse, I mean, we just recently were put out, I think, on the Triangle Business Journal, and I saw the cover of the magazine. I didn't actually read the article, and it said it was boasting about Quintiles brain power. We have about 1,000 MDs and PhDs, and I would like to include veterinarians and lawyers in there too. but anyway, there's a bunch of smart people at Quintiles, and that's actually one of the blessings of Quintiles is that I work with some of the most incredible people that I've ever met in my whole life.
Sure.
And you know, by taking all that brain power and putting it to work, we are making it better for the patient. We're making it so that we can get to market quicker. And with our knowledge and our background, you know, we say to ourselves, there was a recent strategy call we had on, and it said something, you know, if it's not us, then who's going to do it? You know, we're the ones out there. We understand how these trials work. We know how to make efficiencies. Mm-hmm. We have incredible resources around recruitment, feasibility, and different works that are actually, you know, the grassroots right down to the patient. And as we leverage these things and change them, like I said, it also changes our partners and our allies, where they trust us with more and more. So I think we're going to become a larger, more of a partner with industry, rather than as just seen as, like I said, you know, for lack of a better term, the hands and the feet, because we're trusted, we're gaining credibility, and as we work on all these trials, we're actually gaining experience. So, you know, mm-hmm. we want to leverage that experience for and on behalf of our sponsors, but ultimately it's also for the patient at the end of the day.
Absolutely. That's well worth keeping in mind, as you say, constantly. So, Ray, how might this all evolve? And because certainly there's been an evolution from the foundation of the company to today, a remarkable evolution. How might it change over the coming years as the business models evolve? Because certainly the pharmaceutical industry is changing rapidly, partly as a result of companies' association with companies like Quintiles. Where do you see this all going?
Yeah, it's still exciting. I mean, on one hand, I think it's still being figured out. On another hand, we know some things that are working, and we've had some success stories, so we're trying to leverage those success stories and try to take the learnings from those and replicate them with other sponsors and with other products, with other pharmaceutical products. So I think we're also finding demands from the industry that are asking for certain things, and sometimes when we don't have it, we may actually acquire it so that we can kind of get that immediately rather than grow it over a long period. We have made some mergers and acquisitions and things of companies where I know around things like biomarkers and things where when you're looking at to study a drug, you need to know if it works, but you may not actually have some of the clinical data, or it may take an awful lot or number of patients, a lot of money, or there may be a lot more risk to the patient for that. So they use things like the biomarkers. Mm-hmm. A biomarker would be something like, you know, blood pressure, but it tells you kind of what the health of your heart is by knowing that. So it's an indirect measure of your heart health, but nevertheless, you know, that's why we all get our blood pressure done. So that would be like an easy one. And then there's very sophisticated molecules. And there's folks that actually just, you know, leverage on that.
Sure.
So we've done
like
that.
Like proteomics and metabolomics and
exactly.
Those kinds of things. Sure.
Exactly, Ernie. Mm-hmm. So so we have like, we've actually ramped up groups to actually do that. And we're trying to look at all the areas where we can leverage, because if we save a little time here, a little time there, it actually comes down to at the end of the day to get the, like I said, that market out quicker. So we're doing that. So I would say there's improvements on that. We're also doing improvements on the way clinical trials used to be run. And that has to be done in the context of regulation, because there's things like the FDA and the EMEA in Europe and others that sure. regulate that. Mm-hmm. And you also have to have scientific buy-in. So there has to be a scientific community that buys in that that's the right way. So like sometimes people will come to us, like for the investment world, where I'd look at it and it might be scientifically valid. If it wasn't validated by the regulators, it wasn't as valuable, because it still has to be validated by them. So you have the scientific community, you have the regulatory community. So we have to work within those two. And that's one thing I think also where Quintiles has played a role too, is we've been able to influence both of those communities. So we've been able to influence the physician communities. I currently work in an environment called biosimilars, and that's basically in its kind of simplest form, almost like a generic of a biologic. So a biologic, by definition, would be something that would be made from a living animal or a portion of a living animal, maybe made by cells or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
as opposed to small molecule.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly, which is kind of just like a chemical synthesis. You can make it just on a bench or something like
Indeed.
That.
Uh-huh.
So I'm working on those. One of the reasons why we want biosimilars is because they can be cheaper than the originals. And a lot of the originals are very, very expensive, like hundreds of thousands.
Right.
And so if we can bring it to the patient and market quicker. So we're doing on that. Now, you have to have an educated investigator database in order to do that. So we actually have a tool called Biosimilars Knowledge Connect. And we had 200 trained investigators that had joined up for that, that would be ready to work on these trials for biosimilars.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have over 800.
Wow.
So we want to grow that more. And the more we educate folks about the value of that and ultimately the value for the patient, then the better off we are. And it makes it smoother for our clinical trials. It makes them up quicker. And it gives us also a competitive advantage. So it just works for everything all the way around the the edge.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you described your work in biosimilars, because I was about to ask you about your new position working on that. And I'm glad you also explained what those are, because that was an anticipated question as well. So is the trend then that some of these biologics will be sort of genericized over the coming years, and those huge costs for some of those will start to come down because there are more or less generic or biosimilar versions?
Absolutely. Ernie, we have some precedent over in Europe. Our European colleagues are a little ahead of the United States in that regard. They've actually had biosimilars approved through their pathways for several years now. I know that we've worked on them for, I think, a span of about a decade. So we've actually worked on them before.
Okay.
The United States has a specific pathway called the 351K pathway, and that's just one of those things where when you're in regulations, they always have to have numbers and things around them.
Right.
But that's a certain pathway that's developed just for biosimilars. As of today, as I sit here, there's been no drugs, no biosimilars approved in the U.S. by the 351K pathway.
Has the FDA issued guidelines for this kind of thing?
Guidelines came out in 2012 for it, but it's still kind of on a case-by-case basis. And the FDA is very cautious about being, because at the end of the day, they want to ensure patient safety, right? So before these things get on the market, mm-hmm. there's also a lot of market dynamics because there's a lot of money at stake. And one of the things that we're at the conflux for biosimilars is that some of these products, a couple of things. One is these products are now coming off a patent, so they're no longer protected. Now, 20 years ago, we didn't have the technology to copy some of these complex biological molecules because at the heart of a biosimilar, you have like an amino acid backbone, so a series of protein chains.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's different little tweaks on them like glycosylation and different things like that. So it starts to get kind of complicated quick. And then, and honestly, like 20 years ago, we probably didn't have the technology to copy some of these large proteins, molecules, because they're made by living things too. So you don't have the control as you would over like a small molecule synthesis like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have that though. Now the technology's advanced and we
can
do
that.
Some
of that work has been done at NC State, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Just I always like putting in a plug for the engineering masters at NC State, since I'm an alumni.
Indeed.
But no, absolutely. And these things are groundbreaking because now that you can do that, folks can do that. On the other hand, you have a certain fraction of people who have very expensive franchises they want to protect. And then you have other people coming in there. And, you know, all the way up through the president of the United States is all for trying to reduce costs for everyone. And I think everyone in general agrees with the concept. So you have that faction as well. And so we're kind of at the interface right now. I would say that not everything is fully known and fully all worked out, which is probably why, you know, none have been here. But I can also tell you that they're coming.
Okay.
And we do have we do work with a lot of companies, and we have information gleaned from that. So we know it's coming. We know it's going to help the patient. We're not quite there yet, but we do have some precedent in Europe to see some of the good things and some of the right ways of things doing things. And hopefully we can learn from our brethren as well around the globe about maybe better ways to do it in the U.S. So still a little early, but I'm very excited about it. And I do think that it'll add another medicine in the armamentarium for patients that'll be a little cheaper than what they got when it was branded.
Sure. So part of your new title is Global Biosimilars Strategic Planning, which implies that you are taking that global view and monitoring the developments around the world in this area. What, Ray, is Quintiles' interest in those trends? Is that looking out for, you know, some of the big pharma allies you've talked about? Or is it looking for acquisitions in terms of startups and, you know, biosimilars that are in perhaps earlier stages of development?
Well, I think because this is so important to many governments across the world that that we want to be a part of it and we want to be a leader in it. So I think that's part of it. We have so many diverse functions at Quintiles that even part of my job is collaborating with them all and making a unified offering to any one of a sponsor. So when a sponsor comes to us, we have a unified offering that the group I work in, the Global Biosimilars Unit, can actually create a clinical drug development plan for a drug and have done it successfully before, and we can continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We can offer regulatory insights to just about all the countries because we have such a large expanse. So we can offer regulatory advice, you know, for what happens in certain countries and what doesn't happen in others. And basically what we're trying to be is at the forefront to make sure that they get to products or that they get to the patient. And then at the forefront of that, we also want to make sure that safety and high integrity is at the forefront of it. So not just within the regulatory boundaries, which we talked about before, is that Quintiles works in a highly regulated environment. But I will say that from working Quintiles for a very long time, I know that Quintiles adds additional protections way above and beyond industry expectations. And that also it's good for our reputation. And at the end of the day, it's good for the patient because it adds additional levels of protection.
I see. You're listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Quintiles executive Dr. Ray Hummel. Ray, I promised you we would talk about due diligence, since that's kind of your wheelhouse at this point, and your former position for quite some time as head of global due diligence. And if I was a listener, I'd be scratching my head saying, what the heck is due diligence? So why don't we start there?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I can tell you, even when I talk to 10 different pharmaceutical executives from different companies and you ask them what due diligence is, they may get different answers. So the world that I worked in from a due diligence perspective was I worked on risk-based, product-based investments. So we would look at a product and see if our company would consider investing in it. And so going back to the Alzheimer's disease example, we worked on with a large-cap pharmaceutical company. They had a couple of products. They wanted to bring it to market. They knew that Quintiles had a very strong CNS or central nervous system background. Some of our folks, I'd put them against anybody in the industry because I've worked with them. They're outstanding. And they wanted to get access to that. They also wanted, this large company wanted access to our clinical trials experience. And they kind of said, let me see you kind of put your money where your mouth is type of thing. And that was within the example where I gave you where we actually recruited, a year early. So we actually proved to ourselves and to others that we could actually, do what we were saying.
Sure.
And it was very exciting because working in that area basically entailed kind of at a more generic level to give you an idea of what a typical due diligence might be, is a person would bring us a product and say, we would like maybe a certain amount of money and we would want... we have certain needs, so we have to get it, say, through the phase 3 trial of development, so the need cost to go through phase 3 trial. We don't have all the experts maybe on the ground to help with everything. We need a couple of experts to supplement our teams. We have a few folks, but we don't have all the folks we need. And then so we would kind of understand that. Then I would form a team within Quintiles, which included our biostatistician, our clinical pharmacologist, our physician, CMC, which stands for chemistry, manufacturing, and controls expert, supply chain experts, different people as needed. And it would depend on how far the deal advanced as to how many folks you would pull in or resources.
Sure.
But then these folks would usually have like a product overview where the company would talk about their product and we would try to find out in a proprietary nature, after a confidentiality agreement was signed and all that, but share information and then understand basically the product's strengths, weaknesses, and unknown attributes. And then we basically went through the process. We would go onto their site. We'd meet all their people. We'd have talks back and forth about it, very candid talks. And sometimes when you found an issue, if you talked to the folks, it was usually much quicker than if you dug through a bunch of documents, But I remember the first one I did, we did a what's called a new drug application or an NDA. Mm-hmm. And this is like over 10 years ago, so it may be dating me here, but it was all in paper copy. And it was like thousands of pages.
I've seen those. They take up a whole room.
Oh, they're huge. And this one was laid out actually on a large, large table. It looked like a cafeteria type table, like a buffet.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the folks said, I'm not sure how to look at this thing. Some of the experts, because they knew the expert, but they didn't know how to. Mm-hmm. And luckily I had worked in regulatory affairs and had to put some of those things together from the ground up, like the chemistry section or the clinical section or the clinical pharmacology section. I had written some of those, so I kind of knew where to go. And we'd pull them out, and then each of the experts would comment on theirs, and then together we'd collect together and determine usually something like a probability of success. And it was a really unique thing because most of the deals I worked on did not progress. So they were abandoned or put on hold indefinitely or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But once in a while we would do one. And it was really exciting to put all of our expertise to work as well as capital to work on behalf of the patient. And I found it to be very, very rewarding personally, and I found it to be very exciting. It was a lot of hard work because you had to travel to the things, and a lot of times too, because of the way the work environment went, it was usually under a very short timeline. So you could only review certain materials, but you were time bound. So, you know, you had to get it as fast as you could, get the best information you could, and make the best decision you could at the time.
Now, was this due diligence strictly on behalf of Quintiles making potential investments, or are there situations where you're kind of being the middleman for perhaps a big pharma client?
Good question. Initially, it was just solely for Quintiles, but then as things got later, we would work on behalf of other third-party capital providers.
I see. Well, it sounds like it must have been just a fascinating endeavor to really get down into those nuts and bolts of a potential, you know, whether it's a bust or a blockbuster, and really see what's happening and hopefully guide that capital in an efficient and effective manner.
Absolutely. I think actually it was one of the most exciting things I was able to do for Quintiles. My role changed over the years in all that pathway that I've done it. When I first started off, I was considered a regulatory expert. And so I would provide my section from the functional area expertise of regulatory affairs, and mainly U.S. regulatory affairs. And I was asked to comment one time if I thought a product would get approved. And the product got approved, and I was so thrilled that I had made the right decision, you know. It didn't quite sell as we expected. So then I realized that you have to understand the whole paradigm before you can actually do that. So I moved from being a regulatory affairs expert to managing a whole team of R&D experts, and then I would make the R&D side of the solution. Once the R&D folks understood it, then you could understand what would be maybe your target product profile or the product profile that you thought most likely that the product would get, mm-hmm. and that's what you moved over to the commercial side, because that's actually is the only thing that you can actually sell, is you can only talk about what's in the package insert. You can't talk about other things that are speculative, only what are the facts.
Sure.
So then that moved over the commercial team. So then I moved to doing not only the R&D teams, but the commercial teams. And then the other thing that became pretty interesting too is not only evaluating the whole product and whole asset and then writing the report, which ultimately went to like an investment committee or something like that, but also to help craft the underwriting between these things too. Mm-hmm. So you got a chance to look at the negotiation as well as the different triggers and different things that people would think about. And sometimes it wasn't maybe what you would think about, because you look at, you know, the world from maybe, you know, I tend to come from the R&D side since I'm a science background. I have that. Whereas, you know, some of my other colleagues, I make sure I have them to offset for the commercial side to make sure that, you know, everything gets its due, and also that it's balanced and it's holistic. It was extremely exciting. And we did almost $3 billion worth of investments over the time period when I was working in it. So it's incredibly exciting. And, you know, the other thing that's really exciting, too, is when you ultimately see some of these products get on the market and actually, you know, help folks, like I said, because a lot of these things can be abstract when you're working in the industry. But then, like I said, when it affects somebody directly in your family, it becomes very personal, very real. And then you can understand the benefit of why you're doing what you're doing.
No doubt about it. It's such a incredibly complex process, start to finish. And I know that prior to your involvement with due diligence, you spent quite a few years in regulatory affairs itself. And in fact, you wrote the book on regulatory affairs, literally. You have a book to your credit, and well done. So I did want to talk to you a little bit more about that aspect, because it is certainly extremely important, as you've described. And I want to hear kind of your success story, too, which we've talked about a little bit previously, but with the Cymbalta deal, which I think fell into that realm. So tell us about regulatory affairs and why it's so important and how it contributes to ultimately the success of launching a new drug.
Well, I'm a little biased because I did come into regulatory affairs, but I still believe that regulatory affairs is a cornerstone of our industry, and you have to know that, because if you don't know the regulations and the boundaries with which you can work, you can't optimize them. Mm-hmm. And regulatory affairs are not perfectly prescriptive. There are different ways to get drugs approved using similar pathways. But I can tell you from all my experience with the FDA that if they say it's highly recommended, then you better do it, you know. So
yeah, right.
it's not really optional, you know. On that hand, on the other hand, I will tell you that Quintiles is very big into thought leadership as well. So they've supported writing. I actually published 2 books, and I'm working on a third. And we've got a chance to publish quite a few papers as well, too. And I think it bodes well for me personally. It bodes well for the company for thought leadership. And it also bodes well in the end for the patient, because if people can understand how to do things better and easier, it's only going to help all of us to bring the drugs to market faster. So I still think that regulatory affairs is a cornerstone of the industry, and it changes. And that's the other thing about regulatory affairs, is it changes. Just like science, you know, the things that were taken as gospel 20 years ago now are falling out of favor, mm-hmm. or something that was in favor 10 years ago tends to fall out of favor. We just don't, you know, they're not getting the clinical data or data to see that it's continuing worth doing something. So I am a big proponent of regulatory affairs, and I think continually it'll be a cornerstone of what Quintiles will continuously keep their eye on and make sure, you know, it goes well.
Indeed. Well, Ray, we've certainly alluded to, at least touched on some of the major aspects of your career. But I'd like to get a little bit more of your own personal history before we run out of time today. As I mentioned, you've been with the company since 1993. Is that correct?
I started on a part-time basis in 93, working as a summer intern.
Okay.
So I got to meet my wife for lunch, because she was working in data management at the time.
Nice. Well, tell us how you became involved with the company, aside from having lunch with your wife, and, you know, what a little bit more about some of the areas you've worked in through the years.
Well, I will have to say that part of the reason I did find out about Quintiles is through my wife, so I do have to give her credit where credit's due.
Okay.
I didn't also understand completely about the clinical trial industry at the time either, because it's not something that everybody just wakes up in the morning and kind of says, you know, I think I'm going to get involved in the clinical trial industry.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I first started at Quintiles, they had these brown bag lunches with executives who would talk about their experiences and stuff. And since I didn't know a lot about it, I went to every single one. And any class they had, Quintiles is pretty interesting. They have their own university, and they have some training that's like mandatory because they believe everyone should know it, and that's great. And then there's a lot of optional training, though, too. And for those who are new to the industry, I think it behooves you to learn about all those things. So I grabbed everything I could get my handle on, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I kind of got to learn about the pharmaceutical industry from there.
Okay.
Prior to that, I was in private practice for almost 3 years in small animal medicine and surgery. I had done that for a while. I had several mentors at NC State who said that your education and training would not limit you to only private practice, but you could do a lot of things. And I've actually had some friends and even classmates at NC State that have gone on to work in things like bioterror, to work in security measures for the United States. Some have gone on to work in like meat inspection or other different things that are not necessarily private practice. And there's a small percentage of veterinarians that are actually in industry. It's probably around 4% or so of all veterinarians are actually in industry in different forms.
Sure. And this is something you've written about. I saw a couple of articles about encouraging veterinarians to open themselves to other opportunities like that.
Absolutely. There's no exact prescription to get into the pharmaceutical industry, so I find it that it's a little bit, you have to be a bit entrepreneurial on your own. And then also, there's a certain mantra that I started to gain when I was in the Peace Corps, was that when you learn something, you have a certain obligation to kind of give back or share back. So from the veterinary side, I've actually worked in continuing veterinary medical education for several years, and Quintiles was supportive of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had courses that would be more beneficial to veterinarians that worked in industry. So while you know, I'm beholden to get a certain number of credits every year to keep my license up, which I do, most of those are geared towards a small animal private practitioner. They've gotten more diverse over the years, and there's other things now. But you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there really wasn't industry specific continuing medical education. And so I've actually been involved in that as well, too, and also helping colleagues who are interested in learning more about it, because it is an exciting industry, and it's certainly afforded me a great career.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that strikes me about your career is your longevity at one address, as it were. That is so unusual in this day and age.
It is. I feel a little old-fashioned in some regards, but I will say that my loyalty to Quintiles has been because it's been a two-way street. They have taken care of me as well, and you know, I have the utmost respect for folks like Dr. Gillings and Tom Pike and our leadership at Quintiles. And I think the leadership at Quintiles is why we've had the successes and why we will continue to have success at Quintiles.
I had a couple of questions I had got fed to me. Our mutual friend Steve Brockman, who I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is one of my underwriters and a friend and mentor as well, wanted me to ask about how the Affordable Care Act, whether it would have an impact on the CRO business or the conduct of clinical trials. Is that making a splash?
I can't offhand think of all the connection of the dots, but I can tell you that it has had an impact on me even in biosimilars, because as part of the Patient Affordable Care Act, that's where President Obama actually embedded the regulatory pathway for biosimilars. So I'm living that every day.
Okay.
So on one hand, yes, it's made a tremendous impact.
So it certainly impacted your life.
Yeah. I mean, so it's something that, you know, we're trying to bring forward. I will say that the story's not completely closed on the biosimilars, like I said, because there are factions that even want to change market exclusivity and change things about interchangeability of the products at the pharmacy level, how long-term products will get to different patients or extended access programs. So there is definitely that influence there. So I guess the simple answer is yes, it does impact our industry greatly. As to far as the commercial payer and reimbursement side, those are sides of the business that I'm just not as familiar with, but I can't imagine that they don't have impacts that folks who know far more than I do in those areas could probably elaborate on. So my hunch is yes, it's just that I unfortunately don't have details in that.
Sure, no problem. Kind of taking the wider view of a somewhat similar question that Steve was curious about, is what do you see as the important trends on the horizon in the coming years for contract research organizations, although I know that's a restrictive term and Quintiles is bigger than just that, but it's certainly an industry leader and leader in expanding the industry at the same time. What do you think it will look like, say, 10 years out? Do you think it'll look similar to what it is today, or will it look very different?
10 years is a long time horizon for someone at my level, but I will tell you a couple of things that I do think will happen, and I think you'll see this. One thing I think you'll see is you'll see more partnerships with groups like Quintiles. We have a couple of partnerships now, very key, big partnerships, five-year partnerships, that are taking on portfolios of products for companies. I think you'll see more of that. You'll see more partnerships for that around that. We have shown people before that we've known how to do some of these things and how to increase recruitment, add efficiencies and things like that. If someone would outsource an entire program to us, there's a seamlessness just by having the whole program rather than outsourcing certain little pieces and stuff. There's efficiencies that can be gained that way.
Sure.
People need those efficiencies. Every dollar counts today. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to see more of those partnerships, and I think it could actually potentially grow very large with a couple of those big things, really large programs. I've already seen it with one program that was announced last year. They've actually had to hire some folks because they didn't have enough folks to even work on that. So there's opportunities, I think, for our company, and it bodes well for everyone who lives in the area. Mm-hmm. So I see tremendous potential for growth right there. I also see down the line, though, and this is a little bit more, you know, kind of thinking, is that there may be impacts, like I said, with the social media we alluded to earlier, and ways that are difficult to define, but I think we need to start thinking about them because they are coming. And I think the classic clinical trial that we've used all the time before, and it's gotten us many approvals, so it's not to say that it's failed us, it's done very well. But I think you're going to see that clinical trial paradigm. I think you're going to see it change. I think you're going to see things moving towards, they just got adaptive trial design product approved, I believe, last year. So I know there's at least one out there. There may be more now. But adaptive trial designs where you try to get the most information out of the fewest number of patients in the best amount of time and yet still maintain the safety paradigm we talked about before.
Right.
You're going to be seeing more of that. I also think that social media, I wrote a paper on that a couple years ago talking about increased patient compliance. using things like having alerts on your phone saying, hey, Ray, you know, have you jogged today? Have you taken your medicine you needed to for today? Have you done this? Have you done that? Reminders and things. You'll see folks that have, you know, shirts that have electrodes on it that can take your blood pressure. That information will go back to physicians and say, hey, maybe we better change his Lasix because he's got congestive heart failure or something. We need to monitor patients. You're going to see the power of the iPhone and, you know, mobile devices and things like that increase and being used more and more, because I see it and I see the, you know, all that future coming, and it is going to come. I mean, I remember when it went from the handwritten case report form when you work on clinical trials, because I had to look at a lot of those ones that were in hard copy. And now everything's done, you know, as you know, when you go to your doctor, even your nurse and stuff, and your doctor is writing now actually on a tablet and actually filling and everything like that. So you're getting instantaneous feedback from things like that. And I do think that the social media will have a huge impact on how clinical trials will be run.
And the opportunity to access all of that big data that is generated by all those technologies.
Absolutely. We only touched on that in here, but, you know, there's not that many people that can that are used to dealing with this huge, large data sets and stuff. And that is one thing that Quintiles is very good at. We have our own data source, and we also know how to deal with large sets of data. So I think you're going to see I think you're just at the beginning of a cusp of a huge industry where you mine that data and you glean insights on that data for how to help the patient. And I think we're just beginning at the end of that, of that era for that. I think the big data is just becoming more and more. And I think the government may even, you know, be sharing more of their data that they get and stuff like that with us as well, too, because, you know, the FDA is privy to a lot of information, stuff that you and I or others can't get to. So I do see data sharing. It's already begun. I've seen it already with large pharmaceutical companies posting that the U.S.
Mm-hmm. In pre-competitive space, as they put it.
Yeah, and even clinical trials now. Mm-hmm. It used to be kind of you weren't sure if it was on or not. Now clinicaltrials.gov is the place you can go, and all U.S. clinical trials by law have to be posted on there. So if you're you know, have a friend or yourself or something is looking about potentially going into a clinical trial, you can find out what's going on there pretty easily today. So I think that's going to be something too.
Absolutely. Well, Ray, it's been a real pleasure having you on Radio In Vivo today, and I thank you for enlightening us about the world of CROs in general and Quintiles in particular, and wish you the best of luck moving forward.
Thanks, Ernie. Really appreciate it.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook and iTunes, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy this program, we do ask that you make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And now we ask you to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks for listening.